Whoa, there we go. Are you still there, Chris?
Yep.
Oh, great.
It sounded like the Ventures on Nitrous or something.
That was Space Express by The Savage, which was a 1960s Japanese band.
Sounded like the Ventures on Nitrous.
Yeah, it really did. In fact, a lot of Japanese guitar music sounds like American guitar music, especially from the 60s, of course. It sounds like American music on Nitrous.
Right. What's the name? Tommy Tedesco on Thorazine or something.
I'll have to send you a disc of music, I think.
Okay.
See what you think. We're back here. Is my recording working? Yes. We're back here with Chris O'Brien, author of The Mysterious Valley and Enter the Valley, dealing with strange goings-on in southern Colorado in the 1990s and before, which we actually didn't get into before. At the beginning, actually, of the book, you talked about the history of that area of Colorado and how it's been kind of a nexus for weirdness for a long time, centuries.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Native American legends pertaining to, you know, mysterious objects in the sky and some of their myths and legends about the area are quite compelling and one of the harder areas of my research to dig into. But it is a very special place. It's the location of the Sacred Mountain of the East, of the Four Cardinal Mountains, of the Southwest, of the Four Corners area. And there's a lot of interesting phenomena that are associated with Blanca Peak, which is the Sacred Mountain, Sisna Jinni, as the Navajo would call it, the Sacred Mountain of the East, the place where all thought originates. And the Great Sand Dunes, which is just north of there, is also probably the epicenter of a lot of the activity that's been reported over the years. Everything from web-footed herds of horses to Bigfoot to sightings of the devil to all kinds of very interesting phenomena have been reported through the years. America's first serial killer came from the San Luis Valley in 1868, Felipe Espinoza and his uncle. And
I was thinking of Albert Packer, but that's which
Albert
was
Albert Packer crossed, you know, the Colorado cannibal. He's from he stumbled into Sawatch after eating his stranded party up in the San Juans over the winter of the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
But my second book, Enter the Valley, goes into a lot of very interesting history of the area. Some of the more celebrated haunted houses and spook lights that have been seen, you know, for over 100 years, and other more urban legend type phenomena. Some of which are still seen occasionally, you know, at present day. But it was a lot of fun combing through a lot of old newspaper articles and, you know, paper archives and magazine archives and that sort of thing. I actually had a lot of fun researching the history of the locale there. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, the 60s is when the San Luis Valley really got on the map with the Snippy the Horse case, which is widely considered to be the first modern cattle mutilation, which I find very intriguing because, number one, it wasn't a cow.
Yeah.
And, number two, it was a case that no other case has ever occurred that's even been, well, there's been one or two that have been similar, but nothing near as sensational as the Snippy case.
Oh, I was going to say, you mean reported and sensational and not because it was weirder than any of the other mutilation cases?
Well, no, both. It was very weird.
How was it different?
Animal, well, the animal was missing every single bit of flesh and tissue and fluids and everything from its shoulders all the way to the tip of its nose. It's like the whole neck and head had been vacuum cleaner cleaned and polished even. Of all, skin and tissue
and
hide and everything.
This was one day. One day after the horse went missing, they found this.
Yeah, exactly. And what a lot of the books that have mentioned this, Snippy case, failed to mention is that there were also two buffalo found on the next ranch over that were also mutilated that same 2-day period.
We'll have to get back to that and find out why somebody would have been why that would have been happening. I hate to say somebody at this point, but why that would have been happening in 1967. Was it kind of quiet pretty much till about the mid 70s with the mutilation phenomenon?
Yes and no. you know, again, I did uncover some cases. There were 15 elk and deer found in a huge pile, all mutilated in the, I'm not sure the date, but mid-50s sometime,
mm-hmm.
about 80 miles north of the valley near Buena Vista. There were some cases that were reported that were seemed unusual from 65. But, again, the Snippy case was an international news story. I mean, that's how I first found out about San Luis Valley when I was a kid. I remember seeing the picture in the World News or the Star or the Inquirer, whatever, and, like, talking my mom into buying it so I could, you know, read this article about this horse that had been, you know, killed by flying saucers. And
uh-huh.
and that's how I first found out about the San Luis Valley. And in 79, when I took a, you know, 20,000-mile trip around North America, a photographic safari with a photographer friend of mine, a photographer. We followed Jim Brandon, you mentioned him. He wrote a really good book that's very difficult to find called Weird America. That's a county-by-county, state-by-state listing of all the anomalous areas
mm-hmm.
in the country. And we visited quite a number of those in that book. And I remember wanting to go to see where the Snippy case was, and unfortunately we couldn't make it up into the valley because they had a huge 3.5-foot snowstorm, and we had rear-wheel drive in a van, so we couldn't make it up there. But
the only time,
you know,
I've been there
aware
was
of the
a big
Snippy
storm
case prior to moving there.
The only time I've ever been there in 87 or 88, there was a huge snowstorm, and we couldn't go too far. We went to Creed and came back,
right?
Which is an old mining town. So, I have a list of questions, but we're jumping around on them. Actually, there were a lot of other weird things going on, and you've mentioned some of the lights and people seeing strange things. Can you give me and the people listening some of a rundown of what was going on there? Maybe a chronology, or maybe from the least weirdest to the most weirdest, something like that. Because it wasn't just cattle mutilations. There were lights flying around on the hills and above the hills and military aircraft. And
craft, I mean, you know, and occupants and everything else. I mean, some, you know, of course, obviously the books go into quite a bit of detail, and it'd be very difficult to really give the listener a real full sense of the kind of history the place has, but you name it. I mean, all different types of objects, all different, you know, types, colors, shapes, sizes, and speeds of lights and orbs and ships and discs and cigars and triangles, everything that you could possibly imagine that's been reported pretty much has been seen there and reported at one time or another.
Why there?
It's, again...
why do you think all this happened there?
It's radar invisible below 18,000 feet.
Oh, because
it's
of the
huge expanse. It's the world's largest alpine valley, and it's a literal aerial playground for the military and possibly or probably some other intelligence that's flying around there. There have been, you know, there are quite a number of celebrated, not well-known, but celebrated locally reports in the 50s, including a very... probably the earliest footage of multiple objects taken by a civilian cameraman was taken on the Canaus River in August 1948,
mm-hmm.
just over a year after Roswell.
Right.
And, of course, the FBI came and took the film, but not after the guy who took it had shown it to Elks clubs and American Legion halls, and had shown it to quite a number of people publicly before they came and knocked on his door and said, you know, in the interest of national security, you're a patriotic American. We'd like you to hand over your film. And, of course, he was a patriotic American, and he thought that, you know, it was his duty to hand the film over. But in my, you know, my research, I was able to find eyewitnesses to actually viewing the film, and it was broad daylight. The objects were less than a half a mile away, and he even did acrobatics for the camera. Let him, you know, gave him time to even change to a second reel. You know, there's a ton of information, obviously, in the books. I really wouldn't know where to begin. I mean, I could, you know, tell you some of the stuff that I personally have seen. I mean, that's always a good place to start because, you know, your own personal experiences tend to be the ones that you rely on for, you know, personally. And,
right.
You know, I've seen and filmed, actually, quite a number of very interesting things. The Salida sighting, Tim Edwards' famous footage of 6.5 minutes of daylight footage from Salida, Colorado, in August 96, was an international news story, and analysis of that footage passed muster with the head video analyst for the Military Academy of West Point, John DeTuro. That particular case, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have probably seen on various UFO programs. I mean, they did, I think, 20 or so segments on that particular event. And there's others, too. I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin.
You know, I, about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was at some sort of meeting or convention, and I can't remember who. Oh, I think it was Mike Lindemann brought video that this guy living in Colorado who had been, he's just got continuous different videos. One was this kind of a red thing that looked like a balloon lit up from inside floating around in a valley at night. And another one was this thing that looked like some metal structured craft with vents or ridges or something in it up above these telephone wires. And it kind of floated there and then moved around, did some weird things. And then apparently the guy kept seeing these things, and then he started having experiences where they started channeling all this this weird
mathematical formulas.
Yeah, that's it. Do you,
right.
do you know about that?
Sort of language, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Very interesting case. Because the media got a hold of it before I could, I stayed away from that one. And again, it was up in the Denver area, which is more, you know, much further north than San Luis Valley. Very compelling case. And Michael, you know, was right to, I think, correct in getting involved. There are some elements of the case that kind of make me scratch my head and go, hmm. But it's tough to argue with visual evidence, you know, unless you can go ahead and figure out how he did it. It remains a mystery.
Did anybody ever discuss with him this? I'm very interested in this alien language thing. There was a researcher named Mario Pasquini who died about 5 years ago.
Right.
That was studying alien writing and languages, and it would have been interesting to get him together with this witness and figure out what he was doing, where it was coming from, because he said a lot of the time he would look at these things, and all of these languages had a one-to-one relationship with English, which was kind of weird. Either that meant that they were making it up, or it was processed by their mind to be that way, or it just came from inside their brain, and they don't, you know, they might not even know how.
Well, again, that case features a person who feels that they have some sort of special destiny. The objects tended to follow him. They attended to appear on command. Those sorts of sidebars to a particular ongoing case like that kind of raises red flags in my mind. You know, I'm a firm believer in the power of the collective unconscious, and you know, I mean, individuals can manifest stigmata and other psychosomatic physical manifestations of faith and belief, and so who's to say that he wasn't so, you know, caught up in the whole thing that he may have been inadvertently somehow involved in the creation process of these actual phenomena. And, you know, again, I it's very hard for me to, without just having a peripheral knowledge, without really going in depth into the case as a researcher and investigator, it's very tough for me to comment on it. But, again, I do have my signal flags that go up one way or another. I do have 2% of my data that I kind of hold back as my litmus test for the validity of a particular person's observation.
Right.
I do tend to look for some red flag clues that either tell me the person is confabulating, making it up, or possibly is delusional, or the opposite, that they're having a true experience. And I do have certain litmus tests that or red flags that go off when I hear a certain phrase or description or what have you.
Uh-huh.
And I think any good researcher or investigator has that sort of that magic term or description that instantly lets them know that they're dealing with something legit or something that's not legit.
Mm-hmm.
And any time a person talks about a plasma cloud around an object, someone who you know, isn't well-read in the subject area, at least, you know, overtly, you know, has professed no interest in, you know, propulsion physics or any of those types of areas that would give them the knowledge to come up with a description that would involve some some of the higher, more esoteric elements of UFO investigation. And I tend to take those cases. I tend to jump on them quicker and more thoroughly than I would just your average. Well, it's all light in the sky, you know. And of course, I get my star map out and say, well, where was it? How long did you see it for? And, you know, I have a whole MUFON investigator, approach to a lot of the preliminary, interviewing and stuff to determine, try to factor out the noise and try to factor out any of the prosaic or mundane explanations for something. But what I found in the San Luis Valley is a vast majority of people are very up to speed on their own environment, and when something happens that is outside of their normal experience, it makes an impression on them. And something that is equivocal or something that could be misconstrued as, like Venus or Arcturus setting or Betelgeuse or some of the more riveting stars, Ceres, for instance, planets, bolides, ball lightning, that sort of thing. People in the valley there tend to know what those things are because at one point or another they've either seen or heard about them, and they can factor them out as possible explanations, especially when you're dealing with trained observers.
Yeah.
A trained observer is someone who's been trained to be able to differentiate between something mundane and something that's extraordinary. And again, to reemphasize the point that I made earlier, I do tend to really trust more so the trained observer than I do the average, everyday housewife, rancher, person, just off the street. So.
Right. The confabulation and the imagination and all that is fine when you're dealing with lights in the sky, because you kind of know where people might be coming from or where to start looking. But then you have something so concrete as a dead animal that's cost somebody a couple hundred or a few thousand dollars sitting in their pasture, and all that's out the window.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with hundreds of pounds of physical evidence. That's why the cattle question has been so intriguing to me, because that is one of the few so-called paranormal mysteries that do leave behind physical evidence. And I'll tell you, I've seen some cases. I mean, people should tune into my website, TMV, the Mysterious Valley, tmv.us, and go to the visual evidence section of my site. And there's a picture of a calf there that... That particular case was the real deal, and that was one of two that made my hair stand up when I was there investigating it. And
why is that?
Well, just number one, the thing wouldn't rot. It took quite a while for it to finally go necrotic, which is highly unusual. Had a very strange medicinal kind of smell to it. It was found in a pristine pasture that had several inches of fresh snow, and all the internal organs, except for the two most sought after by predators and scavengers, the liver and heart, were gone. The spine was gone. The brain was gone, but no break into the cranium. And there was one drop of blood on its left rear hoof. That was the only drop of blood we could find in a pristine snowfield. Now, whoever or whatever did that was very talented. and the spine was broken out. The spine between the hips and the base of the skull were broken out in an upwards motion, which was physically impossible because of the proximity of the hide.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. Also a case further south in the valley that David Perkins investigated. The animal was missing its spinal cord. Now, how the heck do you take out a spinal cord?
Yeah, without ripping apart the whole animal.
Yeah, and leave no trace. I mean, the spinal cord is, obviously you can get it out, but you're going to leave all sorts of forensic evidence behind that that would suggest how that was done. So this particular case, it was a calf in near Del Norte, Colorado, also had, unrelated to the actual report of the calf's demise, had a motorist that the night the calf was mutilated reporting strange lights right over the area where the calf was.
And they'd seen the calf alive. They'd seen the calf alive the day before.
Yes, exactly. And then that night, a motorist stopped by the sheriff's office and said, "There's some really weird lights, you know, just west of town there." And then shortly, a matter of minutes or an hour later, I think somebody else in the area called and reported strange lights out there. And so these were all unrelated to the actual rancher's report, you know, the following day to the sheriff's office about the calf. And when I went out there, I wasn't able to get out there for 3 days, but I was assured that it would be in great condition because the thing wasn't going to rot. For some, it wasn't rotting. It was, they kept it in a heated garage on a piece of plastic.
I was about to
ask.
I put
my nose right on it, and that thing did not have any cadaverine molecules coming off it at all. And cadaverine is what makes is the molecule that makes a dead body stink like a dead body.
Uh-huh.
Putrescine is what makes a garbage, you know, type smell or rotting.
Yeah, I was going to ask, since it was winter, obviously things would rot a lot slower, but you've just thrown that away because they went and put it in the garage.
They put it in a heated garage, exactly. So that particular case did stand hair up on my chinny, you know, my neck and my chin.
Uh-huh.
I got some very good video footage of the, you know, of the site and the case and some very good still photographs. And one of which is on the website. Again, that site is T as in Tom, M as in Mary, V as in Victor, tmv.us for you space fans out there. Looking at the totality of this particular phenomenon, the National Institute of Discovery Sciences about a year and a half ago came out with a position paper which stated some very interesting conclusions based on their, you know, 10 years almost of investigating the cattle mutilation phenomenon. And basically what they think is going on is it's a well-funded, quasi-governmental, for lack of a better term, operation monitoring the spread of prion disease in the environment. Of course, prions are what are the misfolded protein that creates mad cow disease,
mm-hmm.
chronic wasting disease, and
mm-hmm.
other transmissible spongiform encephalopathies.
Mm-hmm.
In humans, it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. And they think that that's what's going on, that a vast majority of these cases are an environmental monitoring program. And I find that very interesting because David Perkins, back in 78, came up with a very similar conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
He noticed that areas where these cases tend to reoccur, regions of high incidence, were downwind and downstream of where we utilize uranium and plutonium. And Ted Oliphant, who was a police chief of Fife, Alabama, investigated over 100 cases in the late 80s, early 90s in Alabama, and came to the conclusion that it was the government involved in some sort of bacteriological experiments, and he later expanded his theory to include monitoring mad cow disease. I think that's all fine and dandy, but it doesn't explain the central core high strange cases, such as the Del Norte calf, such as the case of Snippy the horse, the case of the buffalo at the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo within sight of the entrance of NORAD.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of cases that don't fit, that can't be explained by a human perpetrator explanation. And I do have a sense that we are dealing with something that could involve ritual blood sacrifice. And these cases are probably extremely rare that would elicit a ritualized occult response by humans. But I have a sense that there is an event, a high strange case that occurs, or maybe one or two, possibly even three cases that occur, and immediately some sort of ritual response team, super high-tech equipped, is dispatched to respond to those initial cases. Linda mentioned the possibility of closing down some sort of portal or closing down, doing some sort of what's it called, termination ritual.
What's that ritual called in the Golden Dawn where you draw a circle and to protect yourself from any kind of influence while you do whatever you need to do. Maybe they're doing what you're suggesting is they're doing something like this on a grand scale.
Yeah, in other words, they monitor areas where these cases tend to rear their ugly head from time to time, and usually the initial cases are the high strange ones. Then you might have some that have that occult sort of ritualized element that the media off and on for years has been saying, oh, the Satanists are doing this and all this.
Well, this sounds
like
something
to that.
Yeah, this sounds like 10 steps ahead of that or beyond it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a response. It could possibly be tied into why humans have been sacrificing animals to the gods for thousands of years. I sense a connection there in this modern age. And then you have all your red herring cases that are done to keep people like me, back on my heels and have my attention diverted elsewhere. And then as soon as the media gets involved, then every dead cow in every pasture is reported as mutilated, and then the waters get so muddy it's very difficult to determine, the extent of the real cases and how many of them there actually are. And of course, this is all going, I'm assuming your listeners realize that possibly as little as 1 out of 10 cases are actually even reported or even get any sort of notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more cases out there than are officially being reported or recognized by the media.
What
or science or law enforcement.
This ritual sacrifice thing is very interesting. What have you seen any kind of... Have you been able to draw any conclusions about what you've seen and what's been reported that pushed you in that direction specifically? Because you said blood sacrifice, but, there's brains missing and, or are there things that just specifically look like there was some sort of sacrifical thing and that nothing was disturbed except having a dead cow?
Exactly. There's been a cult sign at a series of cases that occurred on a ranch right just below the border in the San Luis Valley, the border between Colorado and New Mexico, just north of Cuesta.
Mm-hmm.
New Mexico. Over a space of about 6 or 7 years, this one particular ranch had almost, I think, 48 or 49 cases. And the first few had ritual occult-type symbolism left behind, evidence. And it so freaked out the ranch manager, who I actually know pretty well now, he became a devout born-again Christian as a result of this. And that first... In the coincidental appearance of a mystery hitchhiker right in that same time period, a woman that got into the police chief of Cuesta's uncle's car late at night. She was hitchhiking on the road dressed in a red dress, and he wondered at 2 o'clock in the morning what the heck this woman was doing outside hitchhiking, so he picked her up, and she dematerialized from his front seat when he realized that he was looking at her legs, and she had goat's cloven hooves as feet.
This is the kind of thing that makes people tune out immediately.
Exactly, but isn't it interesting that you should have cattle mutilation cases right on that stretch of the road to have ritual occult sign? I just find that very fascinating.
Yeah, but in these ritual occult things, are some of the same things seen that you wouldn't normally be able to do unless you had lots of equipment and people, or were they just cows that were just caught somewhere and had their necks sliced?
Well, again, it depends. I mean, up in Montana in the mid-70s, there was a spate of cases that involved witnesses seeing these robed individuals scurrying around where these animals were being found. David Perkins had some cases out just between Walsenburg and Pueblo on I-25 where robed figures were seen, in the proximity of a mutilation case. And it's very rare to stumble on this type of description or this type of potentially smoking gun evidence. But and I think that that's for a reason, because I think it doesn't happen very often, and it usually only happens as a response to the real super high strange cases. It's almost like warning shots are being fired across humanity's bow, and there's some team out there that's somehow tuned into this and goes and does some sort of ritual blood sacrifice in response to these initial cases to try to close the thing down, and then, boom, do all these red herring cases that can be, summed up to environmental monitoring, hoaxers, red herring cases, true scalpel-wielding surgeons out there trying to do cases to keep people like me and other, you know, and law enforcement people off the, you know, the scent of the chase. I stand alone in this type of thinking. Other, you know, pretty much all the other investigators and researchers out there, and there's not many of us who I talk to about this, they don't want to hear about it. It's even too much for them to get into, it's much easier if it's just aliens, or it's much easier if it's just the government. If it's the government doing ritual blood sacrifice, that's way over the top for even investigators. So I'm having to write the definitive book on the cattle mutilation phenomenon, which is yet to be written by anybody. It's going to be called Stalking the Herd, and I'm shopping for a publisher right now for this, and I probably shouldn't even say that because I'll probably just doom myself for any publisher picking it up. But I do have some evidence from law enforcement sources that do validate this particular theory, and I can't get too far into it, but I've been told by law enforcement that a part of our government does know that there is a quasi-military group out there that's doing ritual magic involving ritual blood sacrifice and not only cows.
Uh-huh.
And the inference being humans.
Yeah, you know what?
Cattle hemoglobin is a virtual match to human hemoglobin, and humans are preferred, but cattle are a good sort of second choice, shall we say.
You know what's very strange is that before she died, Carla Turner made the same inference to me in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
She did, and I didn't hear anybody else talking about it at the time.
Yeah, well, that was probably right after I had a talk with her.
Maybe so.
Colin and I talked about this a couple of times, and I've talked about it to other people. I mean, there's other interesting parallels that involve these strange cattle deaths and prion disease, for instance. It's amazing to me that nobody has noticed that as soon as crop circles in England, for instance, started to get complex, in 86 you had your first circle that had an actual ring around the outside, the first pattern complexity.
Mm-hmm.
That's right when mad cow disease broke out in England.
That's right.
And if you follow the increasing complexity in crop circles, it's a bell curve that matches the exact spread of mad cow disease in the environment there. And nobody has noticed that. I told Colin Andrews that, and he said, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. I just blew him away. He couldn't handle it. I find it very interesting, too, in October. Well, let's go back to the Snippy case in September 67, the first outbreak of prion disease known in the environment occurred within days of the Snippy case in Colorado. And then in October 97, we had a blowdown event of 20 million trees were blown down in less than 5 minutes, and within days, we had a re-blooming of chronic wasting disease in all the deer herds in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other parallels that may be drawn between these cattle deaths and crop circles and the spread of mad cow disease. All this stuff is their ingredients in this weird stew, and I'm still at a point where I'm not quite sure how much emphasis to put in which area, but I definitely think all the ingredients are there for a pretty interesting recipe.
Yeah, I was going to ask, well, what do you say to these people like Linda Howe? I think David Perkins might, frighteningly enough, agree with you on a lot of these points. But
yes and no. He as soon as I start talking ritual magic and blood sacrifice, he totally tunes out and gets actually quite indignant. Linda doesn't want to talk about anything that doesn't have to do with either aliens gathering genetic material, or I guess her latest thing is time travelers and Dan Burrich. Maybe it's time traveling humans coming back to do hemoglobin experiments or gather hemoglobin from cattle to save us in the future or something. It could be, you know, I've often joked that it could be, you know, cattle are going to be illegal as a protein source pretty soon. They're the most detrimental thing in the environment right now besides humans. More, you know, rainforest is being cut down and burned to create, you know, grazing land.
Right.
And cattle flatulence and cattle, you know, belching.
Yeah.
Is, besides termite mounds in South America, are the largest single natural form of ozone-depleting gas.
Uh-huh.
Or or a source of ozone-depleting gas. So I think at some point, you know, with the emerging health crisis that we're going to be facing, I think fairly soon, involving prion disease in beef, I think we're going to see cattle be illegal as a protein source.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know it's not high-tech chefs coming back from the future to gather, you know, what are in the future delectable soft tissue organs for $1 million placed illegal dinners in the future? You know, it makes as much sense to me as little grays from Zeta Reticuli coming and
yeah.
You know, reaming out cattle anuses and
right.
Lipping ice stew, you know.
Uh-huh. And then eating strawberry ice cream afterwards for dessert. it's total. I've never really heard this theory. You sort of hinted at it in the book. In the first book. And there's a weird thing at the end of the first book, which may have a connection to this, and I want to know if you wrote about it in the second one, what you found out, which was this crystal skull thing on that ranch. It was right at the end of the book, and you kind of cut it off.
Well, yeah, because I was in the middle of my investigation right when the book had to be turned in. That turned out to be the only hoax that I ever uncovered that was
pretty good. Oh, really?
Well, yeah, the woman knew who made the skull and pretended like she didn't. I found out that it was a guy named Brad Shattis, who's a very talented glassblower in Denver,
mm-hmm.
and he had put it there on his parents' ranch, and they lived next door to her.
Oh, I see.
And that's where she found it. And, of course, in the second book, then, I debunk myself. I never make claims that it's high strange. I just find it very interesting that a glass skull should be found in the San Luis Valley. And, you know, of course, I instantly called, you know, Nick Nocerino and all the, you know, the top experts on the Mayan glass skulls, and
mm-hmm.
and they all laughed and poo-pooed me and said, no way, there's no way it could be anything high strange. And sure enough, with some digging and some good investigative work, I was able to find the guy, the artist who made it, and I do go into that in detail in the second book.
Oh, okay. I hadn't read it yet, obviously.
Well, that's all right. I'll send you a copy.
Okay, thanks. It's so weird to hear that somebody in the government might be doing some sort of ritual sacrifice. Why would they be doing this, Chris?
Well, you know,
you hinted at it, but
I was told by a law enforcement officer that maybe what's going on is for being done for our own good, and maybe it's something that the public has no need to know, and maybe you should question your motivations by even trying to figure out what it is, let alone telling people about it.
How do you think he came up with that idea?
Well, because he was told by another law enforcement officer who was an expert in ritual crime, who was called to Washington to testify in front of a secret congressional inquiry group about some sort of group outside of the government but with access to military technology that was doing ritual occult crime. And they mentioned the cattle mutilations as one aspect of this
mm-hmm.
occult crime.
Are these people that might have been formerly in the military? See, that what brings to mind is Michael Aquino and his whole.
Oh yeah.
His whole milieu, his whole group, and something like that, except taken to another level, or something that Aquino might not talk about, because sometimes people get in the military and they get in very very strange company. I mean, just look at Oswald, and. When you get to that point and you have people that are high in rank and have access to these things, who knows what they would be doing. But you just said they would be doing it supposedly for our own good. Aquino wasn't really doing it for anybody's good but his own and his friends.
Well, yeah, and not being totally up to speed on a lot of his activities, although, of course, I am familiar with who he is and some of the things he was involved with. I don't think... you know, that it'll ever come out, you know, the extent of some of the types of very interesting, for lack of a better term, you know, programs of...
prosecutable programs.
Yeah, programs of, I don't know what you call it, mythological programming or psychotronic, you know, warfare experiments, whatever, however you'd want to
mm-hmm.
politely phrase those types of activities. I don't think we'll ever really know the extent of that, but there is an element in our culture that is very involved in some very ancient practices. And for lack of a better term, I would call them occult-tinged.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a subject area that a lot of people just don't want to hear about. And unfortunately, I think it does tie into the cattle phenomenon, the cattle death phenomenon. And I think that that may be what's at the core of it. I think a majority of the real high strange cases, high strange meaning somebody came in and killed the cow and took the organs or something did. I think a majority of them, again, are environmental monitoring for various reasons. You can monitor all the various kinds of pollutants in an environment by taking soft tissue organs from grazing animals.
Right.
And another interesting thing pointed out to me by a doctor is the organs that are taken from these cows tend to be the organs that humans get cancer in the most.
Right.
I also find this an interesting correlation. But again, I think if 100 cases are there, you're only going to have maybe 2 or 3 that are these high strange cases, and then maybe another 2 or 3 that are ritual responses to them. And the other 90 to 95 cases are some sort of subterfuge or environmental monitoring. Now, that's not to say that little grays from Zeta Reticuli aren't responsible for those initial, you know, high strange cases.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that whatever it is, it's been here as long as we have, because we've been sacrificing animals to the gods for thousands of years. It stands to reason that we would sacrifice the weak and sick animals rather than the gods come down and take the good, healthy breeding stock.
Right.
And I find it also very interesting that it's 99% of animals that are found in this mutilated condition are hybridized animals. They're not pure breeds.
Why would you think that?
That you'll never see written anywhere.
Why would you think that? See, Gabe Valdez pointed out to me that the ones he saw were all seemed to come from the same line. Like they would take it from either the same stud bull or whatever, but they all had a similar genetic background.
Exactly.
And they'd leave the other ones in the herd alone that came from they're from different bull lines.
I've never been able to find a case with a Brahma.
Hmm.
And I've never heard of a case of a cattle mutilation in India, where there's quite a number of Brahma bulls.
Yeah. What about outside of the United States?
Oh,
anywhere.
They've been reported. The first science fiction film ever produced came from Australia in 1906. It was called Haunt of the Billabong, and it was about sheep mutilations in Australia. There's one for your film buffs out there. They've been reported in all manner of countries. I mean, since 2000, we've had over 2,000 cases in South America. And that's where they've been putting their attention, where the great cattle herds on the planet are down there. The Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's herds down there. They're evidently monitoring the spread of prion disease. That would be my guess.
Has anybody actually ever seen this going on, ever?
There have been some claims, yes, but nothing that I can personally attest as being accurate and true. I shy away from making, you know, broad sweeping judgments about
mm-hmm.
cases that I have no personal involvement in. I do tend to trust certain investigators more than I trust others in terms of, you know, the potential skew maybe or bias in a particular viewpoint and investigative techniques and what have you. But, I would be real hard pressed to, I've only had two that I know of, two cases, well, two, one series of cases and then one other case that had elements of cult activity involved.
In the entire 10 years or so you were there?
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, they're very rare, but they tend to be the first, the precursor cases, the ones that start a flap going. Generally, you try to get as much of the investigative and research on a particular case or ranch done before any media gets involved, because as soon as the media gets involved, then everybody who sees a dead cow is going to report it as being mutilated, because the first place the predators and scavengers go is the soft tissue organs, because they're the easiest way to get into the viscera. So, I mean, they're going to go through the rear end, they're going to go through the mammary, you know, the bag, they're going to go through, try to get to the tongue. And, you know, I've had cases that have been scavenged by a huge flock of eagles that just totally blew away a rancher, and yet they wouldn't touch the part of the animal that was truly mutilated in a high strange manner. So
mm-hmm.
there's lots of misnomers in pop culture, sort of knee-jerk beliefs about the animal death mystery, and hopefully this book, Stalking the Herd, will set the record straight in terms of what exactly how we define the phenomenon, how we can classify it, and what cases truly deserve our attention and what cases don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have got a little bit of time left, but I wanted to ask, you sort of hinted at why some group would be doing these ritualistic type things with the cattle, and you seemed to hint that it was for our, you said it was for our own good and to help us. What are they protecting us against? What do they think they're protecting us against?
Why does the rabbi draw a circle around the animal and slay it by hand and not allow its belly to touch the ground before it's dead?
Mm-hmm.
You answer that question, and I think you may have just answered the question that you asked me.
Yeah, because it is written.
There you go. Well, I think everyone that eats beef in this country should have to go through a 3-day course to be certified and be a card-carrying beef eater and see what actually goes on to bring that meat to your supermarket and onto
mm-hmm.
your table.
Right.
It is not a pleasant subject, and most people, this is, one of those closet subjects in Western culture.
Right.
And so is ritual blood, using blood as an elixir for some sort of ritual or occult means. It's, in the Christian church and the body and blood of Christ, is basically an adaption of
sacrifice,
the only other religion that really was vying for power in the first century A.D., and that was the Mithra cults, and instead of the blood of the lamb,
they used the bull.
Christianity, it was the blood of the bull. And you literally were baptized by the blood gushing out of the neck of a bovine. And people don't want to, generally the majority of people really don't want to think about those sorts of things.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So,
how has it affected your diet, Chris?
I only eat organic beef.
Oh, okay.
And I don't eat very much of it. I only eat organic meat, period, or natural meat, and I try to get it from sources that I know, the people who raised it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way. Don't eat anything. Don't eat pepperoni. Don't eat any sort of manufactured beef.
Right.
And that's a very good rule of thumb for your listeners. There's some things going on in the food chain right now that you're going to have to know about soon.
Or it's going to make itself known to you.
Oh, yeah. You got a 40-year incubation for certain genetic types. For most people can't catch mad cow disease by eating mad cows, and the ones that can't catch it are the ones that have the gene for cannibalism in them. The ones that don't have the gene for cannibalism in your genetic past are the ones that are most susceptible, and they'll catch it, within a matter of months or a few years.
Hey, whoa, what's this? What's a gene for cannibalism?
That's an interesting study that's been done, that evidently there is a gene that does equate, genetic susceptibility to prion disease.
Hmm.
If you're not protected with some sort of history of cannibalism, going back into your genetic past, if you don't have that gene for cannibalism, you're way more susceptible to catching prion disease. Everybody has prions in them. It's just a matter of when they... when they decide to affect other proteins and make them into misfolded proteins, and then you get the spongiform effect in the brain, where the brain turns into Swiss cheese and you die of dementia.
Uh-huh.
A university in Pennsylvania did a study. They did autopsies on every case or every death that was reported as Alzheimer's or dementia, and they found 30% of them were actually prion disease. That's another study that has not been made known publicly very much.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, then, it could be upwards of, 300,000 people a year are dying of prion disease in this country already, and we just don't know about it.
Yeah, well, if that did come out, the beef industry would be over. Whether it was scientifically connected to eating beef or not.
Well, you're not going to hear Oprah telling people that one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Chris, you've told us a lot of extremely frightening things, which I'm very happy to have on my program. And,
well, I'm sorry it wasn't Halloween, Greg.
Well, that's okay. It's always Halloween on Radio Mysterio, so it's just part of the reason for the name.
Well, like I said, we were just scratching the surface, man. So we'll
exactly.
have to do it again another time.
Yes, please. In fact, as you get closer to your writing and or publishing your book, God, I know of at least two or three people who you should shoot that to, but you probably already have. We will talk again, and I hope that's sometime soon. How long are you going to be living in Arizona there, do you think?
Well, hopefully I'm semi-permanently situated here. I really love the Sedona area and just love the West, and I've been told by Native American elders this is, you know, a part of the world that's one of the safe areas. There's all kinds of end of days type stuff, maybe right around the corner, who knows.
Yeah.
And so why not hedge your bets and be in a place that's supposedly one of the safer areas? So,
yes.
You know, that's not the main reason why I'm here, but it's definitely
uh-huh.
a factor.
The Mayans said so, the Kali Yuga's winding down, etc. You know what I always found very interesting, even though we're just about to end here, was that that the Hopi said that they chose to live where they live, in the, you know, in the middle of the mesas there, in that one little area, because they were told that that was going to be one of the safe places when things started to go wrong.
Exactly.
By
the Hopi.
How the hell did they know that, you know, 800, 900, 1,200 years ago?
Well,
when every place looked like that.
That small little area in the mesas, because that's where the government put them, surrounded totally by the Navajo Res.
Exactly.
You look at the Navajo Reservation.
Right.
In the whole Four Corners area, that's actually Hopi land. They just put them there because they never signed any treaties with the government, and
mm-hmm.
They refused to. And so they surrounded them with their enemies, the Hopi, who were, you know, late arrivals. They only arrived 20, 30 years before the Spanish did. So
Navajo, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas the Hopi have been there for, I mean, that is a primordial culture there. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you go to a home dance and see those outfits that they're wearing, you know you're looking at something ancient.
Yeah,
put it
exactly.
That way.
Okay, Chris, unless you got some... Oh, you know what? You should give out your web address again and any other kind of advertising or anything that you want to do while there's still people listening.
I don't do this to promote myself and make money. I do it to try to get people up to speed.
But you did give up your time, so...
Yeah, tmv.us is my website. If you want to email me, it's cob@tmv.us if you want to comment on the show or maybe share some insights or information that you know, the listeners might have. Again, cob@tmv.us.
All right.
And my website's tmb.us.
All right. Okay, we've been speaking with Christopher O'Brien. If you want to pick up either of his books that deal with what we've been talking about in much more detail, except for the evil, occult, quasi-governmental idea.
I hint around at it.
Really? Okay.
A little bit.
We might talk a bit more about that next time and really get you going. I've got a few ideas up in that area, too, which have to do with the Navy. But we'll leave that for next time and thank Chris very much for coming on the show tonight and hope you had fun, because I know I learned a lot of stuff that I never would have unless we just talked. And I'm very selfish about the show.
Thanks for having me on, Greg, and continued luck and success with the show.
Thanks very much. Talk to you later, Chris.
All right, man.
Bye. All right. It's been Radio Misterioso. Thanks for listening. Maybe we can go out with the... God, I play that song all the time. Here's a weird one. I always play Skymen on this show, the song that
works. For calls to the U.S., Canada,
Whoa.
And the Caribbean, press 1.
I don't want to. A song that was produced by Joe Meek, the famous British producer in the 1960s. It's a song called Skymen. This is the demo of it before they even did the real one. Maybe we'll play both and then we'll lead ourselves out on Radio Misterioso tonight. Be sure to listen next week when I probably will be just playing music again. And if Chris is still listening, I'd like to thank him again for coming on.
Simon, where do you come? my darling. All in the summer of a flashing light, me and my darling. As it covered over the day, as the sun was turning red, we heard a voice, and that voice said,
and here's the real one, so called. Whoops. There we go.
My darling, we saw in the sky a flashing light, me and my darling. And as it hovered overhead, and as the sun was turning red, we heard a voice, and that voice said,
children of earth, be not afraid. We come in peace.
Skymen, skymen, where do you come from? Where are you going to, skymen? If you are ever out at night, you and your darling, and if you see this flashing light, you and your darling, don't be afraid and run away, for soon there's going to come the day when all the world will hear them say,
children of earth, be not for we come in peace.
Skymen, skymen, where do you come from? Where are you going to, skymen?
I was told to mention that Jackie is not doing her show Ready, Set, Go tonight, but I think I have an old one here, and we can play that in place of it. Radio Webhead Theater will be here at midnight, an hour and 50 minutes from now. So I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Radio Mysterioso here on killradio.org. Hello.
Scene two. We have Kawaii.org. We have special guests Echo Park Records, Alexis and Marcus.
Alexis.
Sorry, oops. Alexis and Marcus in the studio. What tracks have we heard?
The first one was a bro.
Oops, sorry.
Two, we have Kawaii.org. We have special guests Echo Park Records, Alexis and Marcus.
Alexis.
Sorry, oops. Alexis and Marcus in the studio. What tracks have we heard?
The first one was a brilliant debut by the Blood Arm, and that's off a demo they did, a 4-song EP that came out last fall. And then the next one was Maria No Te Cases by Very Be Careful.